Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, has our society created a charitable industrial complex? And if so, what are its effects? Then, on the Scholar Circle, the politics of emotion. How do emotions drive political outcomes, like violence, war, and genocide? The nonprofit sector has grown by roughly 25%, says our next guest, and given away some $316 billion. All while inequality has grown and some 9.4 million people remain unemployed. It's part of the effects of what he calls the charitable industrial complex that may merely be perpetuating global poverty. Peter Buffett joins us. He's an Emmy Award-winning musician, composer, author of the book Life is What You Make It, and a philanthropist. He co-chairs the Novo Foundation, one of three foundations that is funded by his father, Warren Buffett. Welcome, Peter Buffett.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle. Let's start with this idea that you wrote about in the New York Times called philanthropic colonialism. What exactly do you mean by this?
Well, I'm going to start by saying I'm completely intimidated by the name Scholar Circle, because I'm no scholar, but I'll do my best. And, you know, it's interesting in a way because that framework, the colonialist framework for me started when I was involved with the American Indian culture and learned all sorts of things historically about our country that I never learned in school. So I got sensitive to the idea of a culture coming in to another framework that they didn't know or understand or want to learn about, and essentially in the case of America, you know, try and just completely get it out of the way. And so in a much milder form, I started to hear stories around philanthropic work, and in fact was guilty of it myself, you know, where somebody would think, oh my gosh, well, this sounds like this would be the perfect answer to that particular problem. Coming from the outside, having no real clue to the intricacies and nuances on the ground. And so I guess coined the term philanthropic colonialism. And of course, all the people on the ground jump up and down in glee when they hear a funder say that, because they know firsthand what happens when somebody, specifically, of course, with money, comes into a place to say, I'll solve your problem for you.
So what are some examples of the unintended consequences of this particular phenomenon you're talking about?
You know, I cite one in the op-ed, which is interesting because it's fascinating to read the criticism around that. But, you know, there was a very well-meaning attempt to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS in part of India. I think it was Calcutta in particular in this case. And you know, the idea was a lot of it gets spread through the brothels and through the red light districts, and that I'm sure is very true. So there was the idea of making sure condom use was widespread by distributing them, at least, you know, the hope that it would be used, and I'm sure there was training and all sorts of things. And the first real underlying problem that I didn't mention that does is it legitimizes brothels and red light areas. It says, okay, we're just going to make them better. And if you spend any time with girls that have been trafficked into these areas, the last thing you want to do is legitimize it. So there's that layer of it. And then the next layer is, in fact, the shifting pricing structure because of it. And the girls will get paid more if they have unprotected sex. Now, some people say, well, that must mean there's, you know, still more protected sex, and isn't that better because they're getting more money? And it's like, not really. It's a much larger problem than that. And yes, that might be a little bit of a consequence, but again, the larger point is it's legitimizing the practice and putting these girls in even a more complex situation that is not of their preference in the least. And so that's one example.
The other thing that I thought was really interesting was this kind of juxtaposition of you getting to sit in on some of these conversations that you witnessed because of your dad,
right,
and seeing the left hand creating the problem and the right hand trying to solve the problem. And you left it a little bit vague as to who was trying to solve the problem, who was creating the problem, even though I think, you know, most of us kind of have a sense of who you're talking
right,
about.
Exactly. Yeah.
But for those who don't quite understand what you meant by that. Who was in the room?
And that's the thing, is that I remind everyone that the emperor has no clothes story was not about shaming the emperor. It was about saying what was obvious. And so it's true, you know, that there's this tendency to say, tell me more. The truth is, and this is the complexity of the world we live in today, is when you're in the room with any entity that is a global corporate enterprise, of which, you know, they're the ones with the most money, and therefore they are at these larger gatherings, and in fact they are sitting with heads of state, and these are well-meaning people. You know, that's the other part that's often left out, and it was actually in the op-ed at one point and got edited out, that these are well-meaning people. This is, no one's doing this on purpose, but you've got, you know, shareholder value and quarterly returns and the drive to do things most efficiently as you can for all those reasons happening on the one hand. And so that means that you might be degrading the environment, you might be offering lower wages, and so there's poverty and hunger and all the things that go with that. There's a host of issues that accompany any corporation that is publicly held that is trying to serve its shareholders the best it can, while on the other hand, it is creating often, you know, not always, issues on the other side of the globe around wages and environmental issues and health issues and all sorts of things. And so then when the foundation side of this particular company, or a foundation that has its corpus invested in these companies, you know, that's another whole layer to this, is that it might be a foundation head, very well-meaning, doing the best they can. Meanwhile, they're making money to do good by investing the very dollars in a corporation that is undermining them in the very work they're trying to help solve or make better. So there's these various layers where the one hand, in fact, is creating the issue that the other hand is trying to solve or make better in some way.
And never mind that all of our pensions are connected as well into these very problem-making systems.
Well, that's the thing, is it's so inextricably linked. I mean, you can look at the simple version, and again, I am not a scholar, so I'm sure every example I cite, that's what I've noticed with the op-ed, is that people can get in there and go, well, what about this? But the truth is, you know, people are clamoring for jobs, understandably, and at the same time insisting at their local Target or Walmart or whatever it might be for lowest prices. Well, those are inextricably linked, and you're going to end up with jobs going overseas and creating other problems because of that to get the lower prices, which then put people out of jobs. I mean, it just keeps going around and around.
And you noted in your op-ed piece that while inequality is rising, the nonprofit sector is growing.
Correct. And people have pointed out that again, no more than I do, that in fact it stayed about 2% of GDP since the 70s. But it still is true that there's more and more affinity groups and gatherings, and it's definitely talked about a lot more and practiced, I think, quite a bit more by high-profile people than it was in the 70s, for sure. I mean, there's a whole different kind of lens on philanthropy today than there ever was 20 or 30 years ago or more.
You've said that in a way, this is another phrase that you coined, conscience laundering, that
right.
Keeps this system in place, and it just perpetuates the injustice.
I think it really does, because again, I think people thought, and rightly so, if you just look on the surface of the piece, that I was indicting, you know, philanthropy as this awful thing. And what I'm really saying is, again, first of all, they're very much well-meaning people, and that it is part of a systemic problem. You know, it somehow doesn't get a pass because it's doing good things. I'm not saying it's the problem. I'm saying that there's a lot of symptoms, actually, that show up because systemically there's something, I think, deeply flawed in what's going on right now.
How many of those kind of meetings did it actually take for this to dawn on you?
Oh, that's a great question, because we have been working in the philanthropic world at the scale we have for the last 7 years. And for instance, the philanthropic colonialism the concept or verbiage came out early on, like within the first year or so, I started saying that. And then you start piecing the puzzle together by going places, experiencing things, obviously, talking to more people. And, you know, there were, we don't really go to too many every year. And there's plenty of value, by the way, in going to some of these. I mean, I went to the first Clinton Global Initiative in 2005 and learned a ton. And it was life-changing in some ways in terms of our focus. So there's value as well as, you know, the starting to observe the complexity of the whole thing. But it was over the 7 years, and then finally it all kind of clicked this year.
I think you titled the piece The Charitable Industrial Complex.
Right, exactly, because it's just, and it's funny because somebody was criticizing me about, well, not technically because of this or that, and it's like, that's not the point.
Exactly, yeah.
With 800 words, you can only go so far.
Some of the means that some of these charities are approaching is what they think will create sustainable economies, like microlending, financial literacy, might just be what you said, feeding the beast. Do you think that it is?
It can be. I think that some of the microlending practices and the idea that let's just get people into our economy is very destructive. I mean, it's interesting how a lot of people will say, and this makes a lot of sense on the surface, we got to get people living on more than $2 a day. Well, who wouldn't agree with that? Except I would actually flip that on its head and say we should all get closer to living on $2 a day. And that's, of course, extreme. But the idea is that it's not about, you know, pulling people into this economy that sort of, again, is sort of, you know, the snake eating its tail or something. We should think about how do we all get back to, really, because it's all very old thinking, a more community-based, decentralized relationship economy that is fundamentally very different than what we're looking at today. I mean, I do not understand why anybody needs tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in multiple houses and boats and all this crazy stuff, while on the other side of the street or the planet, there are people that, you know, we now actually see. You know, when I was a kid, it was, you know, finish your dinner, there's someone starving in India or something. Well, now, you know what, we see these people and they're real and they have stories and, you know, this is no longer something we can sort of put under the rug.
Your dad, who is one of the most successful, if not the most successful investor, who has made
billions of dollars.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Have you talked with him about this? What is his response?
Well, in terms of the piece itself, he loved it because we come from a family that, you know, I was a kid during the 60s in the civil rights movement, and my parents were both active and involved and deeply caring people. And in fact, my dad knew then, when he was much younger and didn't have the kind of money he had, that he had a particular talent that would probably make him a lot of money. That was an understatement, but that's what he certainly knew that early on, and knew that it should just go right back into the world that helped him do what he loved every day. You know, because for him, it's not, gee, look at all this money, now I can buy all this stuff. It's like, wow, I love going to the office 6 days a week, doing what I do. All this money seems to be piling up. I want to give it away when I'm done to the society that gave me this great gift of doing what I love.
And he has been doing that. As you
yeah.
said, he set up these foundations and he's donating his money in very large chunks back to society. And he pays his staff very well.
Yeah, no, he's a fair guy, you know, and he's, and again, you know, the people that say, well, he just doesn't want to pay taxes, you know, even if he had to pay whatever rate on it, he'd still do the same thing. It's the gesture, again, of saying, look, I am so fortunate that I was able to do what I love every day. This society allowed that. This society gets the money back. It's pretty simple.
Let's move to your own foundation and link it into one of the directions that you were trying to go in with your op-ed piece. You said, I don't know that I'm really calling for an end to capitalism itself. I'm calling for humanism. But given the structures, these things that you've noticed and I've noticed as a political scientist of modern-day capitalism, how can humanism be infused when it's part of the legal structure itself?
Well, that's a great question. And in fact, I will tell you the truth. I didn't want to get into the economic structure debate within the op-ed because, you know, I knew that there could be one, and I think there should be one. But I wanted to, again, bring it around to let's go from transactions to relationships. You know, we have lost that over the past 40, 50 years, 100 years. You know, this is all of this stuff is new, which I want to remind everybody. You know, the problems may be relatively old in some ways, but nation states are only a couple hundred years old. I mean, this is all new stuff. And so we're, you know, we're learning as we go. And instead of drawing fire, you know, by saying specifically this is a flawed structure, I'd rather say this is a systemic problem. Let's look at various pieces to the puzzle and find an answer that results in, again, relationships, humanism, you know, putting the person first before the best return on investment, essentially.
A quick reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Peter Buffett about what he calls the charitable industrial complex and conscience laundering. Let's move then to the Novo Foundation that you are co-chair of and what it is that you're trying to do with that. I looked at your mission statement. It's quite profound, really, to foster transformation from a world of domination and exploitation to one of collaboration and partnership.
Well, yeah.
It's a big vision.
If you're going to do it, you might as well go for it as far as we're concerned. And Jennifer and I both, Jennifer's my wife, Jennifer and I both really thought, you know, and again, this comes from the work in the American Indian culture. It comes from other things we've seen and done in our lives that ultimately we got to get back to knowing our neighbor, knowing ourselves, knowing our community. How do we do that? Because what I've found is that, you know, if you look somebody in the eye, you start to have a different feeling about things than if, again, they're under the rug or non-existent. And if you knew who your banker was, if you knew who your farmer was, if you knew where these things came from and had relationships, which, again, has been going on for thousands of years, I think we'd have a different world today, basically. I think we'd have something where there hopefully was no need for charity, frankly, that the root word of philanthropy, which is the love of people, is really what we're going for. So we figured, why not hang that out on our shingle?
And let's talk about some of the ways that you're doing that. One is you've got a focus on women and girls in particular. First of all, what drew you to focus on women and girls, and what are you doing to support their development and potential?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, only a girl will be the mother of every child. No one's argued with me on that point yet. And so, in fact, when you do support a girl in terms of health and education and all these, you know, possible ways she can live into her best self, you're going to support a whole next generation, boys or girls, because it really isn't ultimately about one gender or the other. It's about everybody. But a girl is a faster way to get there. It's a more efficient way to get there. I mean, now I will get all the return on investment people, you know, mad at me, because in that sense, it is a good return on investment. If you're going to support a girl, you know, you look in the aid world, the development world, and where the dollars are deployed. When they are, and they rarely are, deployed to a young girl or, you know, a young woman, it will stay in the family, in the community. It just has a different outcome generally than it does if you give it to an institution or to a man, frankly. I mean, it's pretty simple in that regard. And so you add the efficiency with the fact that she's going to be the mom and it's going to stay in the community and you get a better result.
And you also said that there are people showing examples of these other ways to live, these other kinds of communities that truly create greater prosperity for all. What are some examples?
Well, that's where we're trying to seed, and that's a key word or concept, really. We're only trying to create conditions for change. We're not sure how change is going to come, and we're not going to try and define what it looks like, but we are going to try and create conditions. So we work with various projects around local living economies, which is also on the website, and ways to, again, foster a shift back to, you know, kind of this decentralized, more relationship literal economy in terms of people that are working on different frameworks around the money system. And again, this is mostly old stuff, just renewed in terms of how communities can be more resilient. And of course, the collapse in 2008 helped us. That was in our favor, sadly, you know, but in a good way. It made everybody look at their neighbor and go, uh-oh, maybe this is where I should focus, because my money in a bank that doesn't know me, or, you know, my food from a farm that I'll never see, or, you know, these various components to my life that are the lifeblood, really, of my daily existence, I don't even know who these people are or where they are, and they certainly don't know me.
You've mostly spent your life being a musician and a songwriter, and now you're also an author. And your message in the title of your book, Life is What You Make It, which is great. But I wonder, from the title, I was wondering if maybe it masks the structural and systemic realities that you're criticizing.
It's interesting because, of course, the first sentence after someone sees Life is What You Make It and sees my last name is easy for you to say. And that's the thing I dispel right away, whether it's live in my show or in the book or anything else, because what I'm really trying to do is reframe or rediscover the real meaning of words. And the first one is probably privilege or wealth or success or, you know, one of those. And I then go into telling my story, which is I grew up in Omaha and I walked to public school and I had the same English teacher my mother had, and, you know, all these things where privilege was growing up in a neighborhood where people knew you and loved you and nurtured you and made you feel safe. So it's really trying to get back to that as what makes us whole, as opposed to the mythology around certainly who my dad is and then who I must be, where it's all about the money and isn't it great to be rich? You know, I joke about the fact that I only recently became Warren Buffett's son. Nobody really cared, frankly, or knew, and that's great. You know, that allowed me to live my life, and, you know, without my dad's help in terms of financial stability or something, you know, I talk about how self-respect comes from earning your own reward. You know, if I had a dad that wrote me a check every time I fell down, I wouldn't know how to get up. So it's really a book and a message around essentially redefining certain concepts around what privilege really is, and, you know, that it's all about figuring it out yourself as opposed to somebody doing it for you, essentially.
Yet, of course, when you talk about the systemic issues, people who don't grow up in the safe neighborhood or people
right.
who don't grow up with that sense of safety and community and are exploited would struggle with that.
Absolutely. And that's actually, I wrote a blog about that because I sat down with some girls who were sold into sex trafficking early on. And I said, how do you say life is what you make it to somebody like that? And you don't. You know, you listen and you learn and you try and figure out how to shift systemically what's going on in whatever way one can. You know, my wife and I are fortunate that we might be able to do things. Certainly others can't, but you never know where it could come from. But there are way too many people that can't say, you know, life is what I make it. There's no question about that. And so I am definitely addressing mostly people with money, you know, kids, regardless, at the university level. I do a lot of shows there. And the whole idea is do what you can with what you've got to make this world more equitable for all, no question.
So where are you on your conversation and music tour now?
Well, I have been doing it a little bit before the book came out. It came out in 2010, and then it's been pretty much a full-time job since then. I mean, I just lied. It's not a full-time job because the foundation is also a full-time job. And so, you know, I'm doing both, and they're sort of interrelated in kind of a curious way, but or they have continued to find common ground in a lot of ways. But I have gone to China now probably 9 times in the last couple of years. The book is a runaway hit in China, and which is probably a topic for another show. But I am very busy out on the road, again, mostly either colleges, community foundations, kind of family wealth management organizations, that sort of thing. So it's an interesting mix of demographic, I guess, out there with the show. And the fun thing about the show, it's called A Concert in Conversation, and I actually take questions through the whole show. Anybody can ask me anything at any time, and that's probably the most fun part for me. So, you know, this is part of how I make a living. You know, I don't take a salary from the foundation, and in fact, I've been a musician all my life and written music for commercials and film and all this stuff, and this is now my livelihood.
We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I've been, you know, not responding to everything because, you know, again, people kind of want to draw you in and down into the polarizing debate around good and bad or this or that, and I'm trying to keep the conversation up a notch, you know, to just say, this is what I see, others seem to be seeing it too, and how do we do something about it?
I think that's the kind of questions that need to be asked and need to be broadcast in the public sphere, as they call it. Unfortunately,
yeah.
Not enough do it.
Yeah, no, somebody kind of criticized me on this idea of writing new code, and what do you mean by new code? And I said, well, Thomas Jefferson wrote new code. You know, I mean, this is not, it's probably something that needs to be done occasionally, and it might be time.
Well, language has a profound effect on reality.
It sure does. It is the skin of culture, as someone once said, and I do think that language and the way we use it has a almost insidious way of kind of taking us towards something that maybe we didn't actually mean, and language is critical to how we move forward. And again, that's why I'm trying to redefine some of the words we use.
And because you're a songwriter and a poet, I think that you're able to do this in a way that maybe a straight business person doesn't.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, is that because I have this different vantage point, you know, partly, of course, because of who my dad is, but also equally so, if not more so, because of what I've been doing all my life, I'm not steeped in it quite like somebody else is. You know, I love to say that, you know, once you start consuming culture, culture starts to consume you. And so if the further you can stay a little bit outside of it to observe it, I think the better in terms of trying to get across some of these ideas that need to be spoken about.
Well, I hope we can continue the conversation at a later date.
Thank you.
Thank you
for having me on the show.
No, it's our pleasure. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye. How do emotions drive political outcomes like violence, war, and genocide? Stay tuned.
Heal the victims of this war, the mother's loss of a child she bore. Heal the father's sorrows and restlessness, a sister's longing. Heal her emptiness. Heal the weeping widow veiled in black, for she knows her man won't be coming back. Heal the broken hearted. Wipe away the tears. Heal the soldier's wounds and the children's fear. Heal the shattered lives and tattered family ties. Oh, let the war be done. Let the peace be won right now. Let the war be done.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. How much do emotions impact or even dictate political outcomes, like ethnic violence, wars, or even genocides? That is a key question posed by international relations theorists, political scientists, psychologists, and communication scholars. Some of the theories relate to the emotion of fear and threat. And the idea that there is no international police force that prevents nations from attacking one another, so all must be prepared. But other emotions also lead to attack. Resentment, hatred, and rage. Where do these emotions come from? How do they play out? We're joined by three experts. Roger Peterson is professor of political science at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and has authored numerous books on the subject, including Understanding Ethnic Conflict, Resistance and Rebellion, Lessons from Eastern Europe. David Altide also joins us. He's a professor of political communication at Arizona State University, and his books include Terror, Post 9/11 and the Media, Terrorism and the Politics of Fear, and Creating Fear, News and the Construction of Crisis. And we have with us Jeff Birkenstein. He's professor of English at St. Martin's University, and among his books is Reframing 9/11. I'd like to start with Roger Peterson. Can you first give us an overview about violence and emotions? And maybe you should start even with the international relations literature that pertains to fear and threat, and then bring us up to speed with what you've been doing.
I should probably mention that I have a book which is called The Strategic Use of Emotion in Conflict, and it deals with actually all the Western interventions in the Balkans, especially between Slavs and Albanians. And the premise of the work I'm doing, which builds off the Understanding Ethnic Violence book, is that the West, and by that I mean basically the United States and the European Union, intervene in conflicts by believing they can introduce sort of a rational choice game, that they can arrange sticks and carrots in a certain way to induce behaviors, and people like the Serbs and Albanians have a little wider view of human nature, one that incorporates emotions, and they see emotions as resources. And they use emotions as resources to basically screw up the game of the Westerners who believe they're imposing a rational game. So there's certain emotions which are very powerful, I think, in being able to be mobilized as resources. Two of them relate to violence, which I think we'll probably pick up on in this conversation, and that's anger and fear. And fear is really based on the cognition that there's some danger, but anger is based on the cognition that someone's done something bad against me. And if you frame what's happened to you in different ways, you can generate either anger or fear, but these emotions, to take a big thing they do, is they shape risk perception. So if you're under fear, you generally tend to upgrade risks, but if you're under anger, you tend to downgrade risks and believe you can retaliate. And sometimes political entrepreneurs wish to inculcate anger if they want to get a violent spiral going between actors. Sometimes they wish to generate fear if they want, especially ethnic cleansing in my cases, if you want to, the other side doesn't believe that they can keep themselves safe, you will separate and you'll get ethnically homogenous groups. So I've spent a lot of years looking to see how political leaders mobilize basically five emotions: fear, anger, contempt, hatred, and resentment. And they would do different things to generate one of those emotions in order to try to mobilize different types of political behavior.
So can you give us an example that really will elucidate for listeners how this actually works, like a concrete example?
If people remember what happened in Kosovo, the Serbs did a massive ethnic cleansing of Albanians, but the Albanians came in after that, and they started, even under Western supervision, they started wanting to intimidate Serbs to leave Kosovo. And really, there are no Serbs left in any of the major five cities in Kosovo today, south of the Ibar River. And if you want, say, in a village, and I was living in some of these villages, if they wanted to create fear, they would leave what they call night letters. They leave a note in the box saying that we have a list of people we're going to go after, and you're number two on the list. When you don't know who put the letter there, where it's coming from, what's going to happen to you or your family, that's a way to generate fear in an opponent, and then the only solution for them was to leave Kosovo. Now, if you were in a situation where you want to create a violent spiral, and before, in 1998, Albanians sort of believed that, in Kosovo, believed that the West was not going to intervene on their side unless violence happened. And so they decided we needed to get a violent spiral. And they hit and attacked certain Serbian policemen. And they attacked the police, not the army, not the other more professional forces. They would attack them in a way, and they would say, "We, the Kosovo Liberation Army, killed a couple of your policemen." And they knew that this was going to generate a backlash because their belief was these Serbian policemen could not control themselves. They would escalate the conflict and generate a violence level, which would trigger Western intervention. So in the one case where the Albanian actors had sort of already won and wanted to sort of create ethnic cleansing, they were creating fear and by sort of anonymous, sort of you don't know where the attack might come from. And in the other case, it was, "We attack you, you think we're inferior, but the inferior people just killed a couple of your people." And that generated the massacres at Rochuk and other places where the United States decided they had to intervene. So those are a couple examples about how political actors actually calculated, we want to get a certain kind of emotion, and that's going to basically motivate the behaviors they want.
And then on the other side, of course, they took the narrative and framed it in a different way in order to get a reaction from that side.
Yeah, but I think that especially in these conflict situations, there's a lot of material that you can sort of work with. But I think fear and anger, you build on violence, and you use violence in certain ways. Contempt is an emotion that the other side is really deeply inferior to you, and I think in that case, violence isn't a really good tool, but you build on sort of other cultural understandings and cultural schemas.
Let's bring in David Altide. David Altide also studies emotion, specifically fear, and how the politics of fear come about through framing in mass media. So the government using certain frames, and then the mass media just disseminating those frames. Talk about the framing and how certain frames might emerge.
I think that one of the key questions is how we actually decide for audiences which steps we should take. A big part of that is what we call how is a situation defined, and framing sets that very clearly. For me, one of the biggest examples when we talk about 9/11 was when it started. How would we frame these attacks? Indeed, even the word attack suggests kind of a frame. You know, how would we define planes running into those buildings? Initially, some of the statements were that, well, these are criminal acts. But then pretty quickly that changed to, well, no, they're not criminal acts, they are terrorist acts. And so the difference between a crime and an act of terrorism becomes really significant, because terrorism carries with it, you know, all sorts of other massive state kinds of reactions. And terrorism also, as a term in our society, has a real history with it and some very heavy connotations, meaning things are going to be pretty random, you can't predict anything, there's this powerful but invisible enemy. And so because of that, we then have to take some very strong preventive actions early on in order to stop potential terrorists. And that in turn led to all kinds of things that Jeff might talk a bit more about later, various kinds of acts of surveillance and preventive detention and so forth, not to mention the kind of armed reaction, invasion of countries and what have you. So that basic framing becomes really significant. We find fascinating about the media is that, to some extent, unlike the situation that Roger just really clearly described with the Balkans, the American situation with terrorism was much different, and it really pretty much depended on the mass media. The situation Roger's been studying, the media play a part, but it's much different because in that part of the world, the people involved in the various wars and so forth have a long history of experience and information about themselves compared to their counterparts, the other ethnic groups. And some of that goes back, as I'm sure Roger knows better than any of us probably, for centuries about atrocities and so forth. For more and more of the world, in terms of terrorism, the mass media are the source of the experience and how these things are framed and set up. And so when that happens, then I think the media play a very strong role in promoting actually fear first, and then out of fear comes a sense of danger, and then, for I think most people, as media audiences, anger comes out of the sense of fear about, you know, what's threatening us and what we may or may not be able to do about it, and therefore I'm angry at them and we must then take some retaliatory action, and then we get into the whole propaganda spiral of sort of framing these enemies in certain very simple ways, justifying actions that we're going to take to protect us. And it's always cast with the notion that whatever we do, we can't do too much in order to keep us safe from these people that we're angry at. And I think that's where the current approach in the world with terrorism has gotten us now, where we're engaged in so much kinds of preventive action, retaliatory action, in order to keep us safe from things that might happen in the future.
I think one of the interesting things that is emerging from the focus now on emotions and political psychology and this merging with political communication is that two things are occurring. One is in the frame, there becomes this kind of good guys and bad guys, the us and the them frame, and that kind of, shall we say, instigates a different kind of social psychology. And then you get this framing of the emotions, which, as Roger talks about in his book, has an automatic behavioral mechanism that sort of kicks in like a little trigger. Perhaps that's a good place to bring in Jeff Birkenstein.
So far, it's a very interesting discussion, and I like the connections between Serbia, which was very interesting for me. I was teaching as a graduate student at the University of Kentucky when the United States and NATO went into Serbia, and one of my best friends, well, she is from Belgrade, she is a Serb, and she came and spoke to my class, and it was just very interesting. We didn't know what to do with it, but it was very interesting to get a very different perspective than our media was then giving. One thing that's really interesting, and I think what David is mentioning, really makes me think about the role of media, even from the maybe first couple hours of 9/11. One of the things I think when you ask people, they have this common experience of 9/11 and the events, because if you were outside of the New York or D.C. or Shanksville or whatever it was, Pennsylvania, forget the name, but of the Pennsylvania area, if you were outside of the immediate impact area, you watched it on television. And everybody watched it on television. So we had sort of this common perception. But what's fascinating is thinking especially about your book, Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, it was almost sort of a reflexive decision that was not nefarious, that probably wasn't an ulterior motive. But if you remember, even from the very beginning, the media, which we tend to believe in our memory, was sort of just, they turned on the cameras and showed us what happened. You'll remember the example of what's come to be known as the falling man. In other words, people jumping and or falling from the World Trade Center. Well, in the very beginning of the coverage of the attacks, we heard and we saw and people discussed it, and there was even a couple scenes where you saw people fall. But even within the first couple of hours, not as a coordinated effort, but at someone in the who had control of the TV cameras and or what was being shown through the TV was not giving us those images. So even after the first couple hours, those images were being taken away from us. It was a way of protecting us in a way that is unfortunate, I think. And that, to me, is really interesting just in terms of what David's talking about in terms of media and promoting fear and then anger, because there was a situation where there was this raw data, if an image of a person falling is can be considered raw data. And it was so raw that there was a reflexive image to cut it off because you didn't know what would happen when people saw it. And then over time, you know, then very quickly it got into the meme in terms of the frame of 3,000 dead Americans. In fact, I still cringe when I hear that today. I heard it just the other day on a talk news show. Someone said, well, 3,000 dead Americans on 9/11. But we really know that it wasn't 3,000 dead Americans. It was around 3,000 people, many of whom were not from the United States. And so just this way of almost reflexive gut-level framing is extremely influential. And then it does lead to the idea of anger and how people can be controlled in terms of what our response is, et cetera.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. We are speaking with Roger Peterson, David Altide, and Jeff Birkenstein. Roger Peterson is a professor of political science at MIT. His books include Understanding Ethnic Conflict. David Altide is professor of political communication at Arizona State University, and his books include Terrorism and the Politics of Fear. And Jeff Birkenstein, professor of English at St. Martin's University, and his latest book is Reframing 9/11. Roger Peterson, let's talk about the idea that things are unjust or unjust. It seemed universal in the conflicts that you looked at that the framing of this is unfair tended to be underlying all the conflict, and those people are doing something or are going to do something that harms us.
Yeah, let me first just to mention what Jeff is just talking about, though, because I think this is sort of interesting. I hadn't thought about the body, but, you know, with a lot of emotion theorists often talk about the cognitive antecedents. What are the beliefs that generate the emotion, and then what's the action tendency of that emotion? If you're under anger, the belief is an identifiable person has done something wrong to you. The action tendency is quite clear. It is to punish that person. Now, fear, though, is a little tricky because the belief is clear that I'm in a situation of danger, but the action tendency could be either fight or flight. There's some speculation. We don't understand this very well. Maybe Jeff and Dave understand better than I do, but I think the framing of the situation, if I am powerless and that's the source of danger, then I flee, then I have flight. But if the perception of danger is the danger is coming from someone who has power, but I also have power, then the action tendency is to fight back. I think the image of a body falling is really a helpless, powerless image, which everyone sort of intuitively understands this is sort of like fleeing. And I think that the media and probably everybody else didn't want that. They realized relatively quickly that we need to fight back, and we can't look so powerless as this body falling down. I think you're picking up on this other emotion, which is of resentment. And the cognitive antecedent, the belief that generates the emotion of resentment, is that my group of people is in an unfair position on a status hierarchy. I think there's a lot of psychology that people think in terms of groups and in terms of group hierarchies. And like in Iraq, the Sunnis had been on top all the time. We came in, the Shia were going to control the country and a democracy by this their raw numbers. And we didn't anticipate at all the power of the resentment of Sunni Arabs to not be able to adjust to not being on top of a hierarchy. In Eastern Europe, because these were empires that crumbled, you had these group hierarchies that were changing. And status reversals are very powerful and very ubiquitous sort of part of politics, which creates this feeling of injustice that you said. And this is another type of a powerful motivator. And, of course, politicians who are smart concentrate sometimes. If they think they can get out of the violence game because the resentment is so powerful of another group, then they will have speeches and parades that highlight the status discrepancies.
Well, wouldn't you say that the resentment is wrapped up with anger in a way, in the way that David Altide was talking about fear and anger? First there's fear, then there's anger. You know, this was unfair. They did this to us. This is unjust. And that narrative that fuels it, and that is what is then fueling the larger wars, even, say, perhaps the United States then attacking, well, first Afghanistan and then Iraq.
Well, I think the feeling that, you know, my group doesn't get what it deserves and this resentment, that makes it easier to use anger. But I think the idea about really talking about emotions in a productive way is to try to be very specific about what they're framing, what the beliefs behind them are. And I think it's a different idea that my group is in a inferior status position, which is resentment, and anger, which is somebody has really done something specifically bad against my group, and there has to be some type of punishment for that.
David Altine?
Yeah, I think that this starts getting at some of the nub of some real differences in the world. I think one of the other very strong emotions that a lot of us have spent a little time looking at, in addition to resentment, is entitlement. And the notion that we are more deserving than others, that a certain way that we want things is how the world really should work. And so if something has happened that symbolically kind of challenges it, that becomes very important. Because one of the other concepts here that's connected to emotions, but has a bit more to do with how we act in the world, is identity. or how do we see ourselves as being known by others? You know, what do others think of us? And if you feel entitled to a certain approach in the world, how dare anyone possibly oppose us, for example, or how dare anyone in any nation challenge our particular God, or how could anyone dare do certain things that we have been given, if you will, God-given rights to, constitutional right to, and so forth. Those things can then become very powerful in the sense of triggering these other things, that you're taking something from us. I'm worried about losing my rightful place here, and so forth. I remember just briefly after 9/11, for example, and again, that's where much of my focus is, was on the term that a lot of people were saying, Americans have lost their swagger, and that's why some of these actions dare happen. We're entitled to sort of rule and dominate in a certain way, and this sort of thing is not viewed universally in the world that way by all cultures, obviously, but I think certain political systems really tend to promote this as a justification for hegemonic rule.
Jeff Birkenstein?
Well, this is so interesting what David is saying. I mean, his article, for instance, in the book, Reframing 9/11, is Fear, Terrorism, and Popular Culture. And if we remember, post-9/11, there was a big chunk of the country, myself included, who wanted to ask what seemed like a simple question is, why did they do this to us? But at the time, that was a very problematic question because it went outside the frame. The frame was, well, they're animals, they're terrorists, they're bad people. I think George Bush said something along the line, they hate us for our freedom. That might be a paraphrasing. It's been so twisted at this point. But that was the response. And so to ask the question is, well, let's take a look at this. Why, from their perspective, not accepting it, agreeing with it, or condoning it, but why did they attack us? And that question was very problematic. And a lot of people wanted to seek out that information for their own benefit. But the response through the media that really was quite a ringleader in terms of a certain kind of reaction that the American people should have, that was really outside the bounds of acceptable questions at the time. You still had a desire from a lot of people to ask that question, so they were asking it in other ways. One of the ways is through popular culture. They would ask it directly or indirectly in alternate methods, maybe not through the media, or maybe not through what Sarah Palin calls the lamestream media, but all sorts of other avenues. Because people desire information. But at the same time, there's always people who don't want to seek out this information, and that's quite a conflict right there. And that gets right to the sense of entitlement that Americans had, and how could they do this to us? Because we, many people say, are a beneficent power. We're a beneficent presence. We're the greatest country in the world, et cetera. All of these sort of slogans we've been hearing for a long time. Those came under attack. And the last thing the media and many politicians wanted to hear, have asked is, well, why did they do this to us?
That response was also framed in a very distinct way. Roger Peterson, would you like to respond?
If the enemy is just inherently defective, there are different emotions. I think hatred and contempt come into play there. But if the enemy is not inherently defective, but for some other reason did bad things to us, then we're angry, we need to punish them, but I think that the struggle is a little different. If you hate someone, the tendency is to physically eliminate their presence. If you're angry, you just need to punish them. And so it's sort of interesting about how Americans frame these terrorists. Are they a small group? Do they actually have reasons? But once you get into reasons, then we can't hate them. And you can't have these campaigns to try to eliminate them as much. So I think there was a lot of that going on. I think Bill Maher, right, he said something about the terrorists were that flew the planes in were had some measure of courage or something, and then he had to leave the air because he couldn't attribute.
They may have been a lot of things, Bill Maher said, but they weren't cowards.
Right. And to say even a statement like that, which I don't think is even that controversial necessarily, to attribute anything good to this at the time inherently defective enemy, that generates an emotion. But, of course, if we get into Iraq, we have to say, well, I think George Bush said Islam is a religion of peace, and he has to go out of to try to not have that framing because those emotions become counterproductive at another time.
This is David Altaiti again. One of the things you have to do in order to generate a certain response from your audience and to generate a response that the audience seems appropriate and therefore see you as a leader is you've got to be able to tap some key emotions, and it becomes a real challenge. And so you've got to define things in a certain way. One way that we help do this is through controlling language and using certain words. Jeff kind of suggested all but banning the use of other words. And so the language starts changing. And let me give you an example. The United States, and we're not the first country to do this, of course, but the United States in both of these wars with Afghanistan and Iraq has paid a large number of people to help us fight these wars. Historically, in the past, when you pay somebody to fight your war for you, that is to say they're not your own soldiers, they're people who are fighting for pay, we've called those mercenaries. Well, mercenary has a very bad connotation to it. Mercenaries, in the way we've read history and been taught it, mercenary is something that other countries sometimes do, and it's really vulgar and, if not immoral, to pay somebody to fight your wars. Well, the United States, including the various companies that we paid to fight these wars, has continued to deny that they're mercenaries. And very few of our political leaders ever refer to these folks as mercenaries. And in some ways, it would be refreshing if somebody would say, well, yeah, we're using mercenaries, but, you know, it's cheaper this way, or so what? And just get on with it and then let people deal with that. So they're not mercenaries. They're the contractors, they're consultants, and so forth. Because, again, mercenaries suggest a certain definition of a situation, and a country such as ours is entitled to certain things because, historically, most countries and most groups see themselves as morally superior to the people they're fighting. This is true almost universally. You know, language helps do that in some very important ways.
Well, we are out of time now, but let me just remind listeners that we are speaking with Roger Peterson, David Altide, and Jeff Birkenstein. Roger Peterson is a professor of political science at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His books include Understanding Ethnic Conflict and Resistance and Rebellion Lessons from Eastern Europe. David Altide is professor of political communication at Arizona State University, and his books include Terror Post 9/11 in the Media, Terrorism in the Politics of Fear, and Creating Fear, News in the Construction of Crisis. And Jeff Birkenstein, professor of English at St. Martin's University, and his latest book is Reframing 9/11. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you, everybody. Great discussion.
That's it for today's show. I'd like to thank all of our guests and our producers, Ankine Aghasyan and Melissa Shiprin. If you missed a part of this show, you can always go back to the kpfk.org archives and listen. You can always podcast us, and you can keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Armudian. We'll see you next week.
Let the war be done. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won. Let the wars be done. Live in peace as one.